Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty. And a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Hey, if you believe in the integrity of the fierce independent press, that's a great reason to support us. If you don't care about that kind of stuff, but you just like listening to this podcast or any of our podcasts, that is a perfectly legitimate reason to support us as well. And it's really easy. Go to CanadaLandShow.com/join or just click the link in the show notes. And this podcast that you might like it even more because you'll get an ad-free version of it. It just takes a minute. Go do it. Andre Demise, contributing editor at Maclean's and co-founder of Resistance Noir podcasting network, brand new podcasting network, joining me from Toronto. Welcome back, Andre. It's been too long.
Yeah, it's been a long time. How you doing?
I'm crashing, man. I just gave testimony before Parliament, and I've never been so amped and so bored at the same time. You might have to carry this whole thing.
Yeah, it's fine. That's okay. I got energy for the two of us.
Awesome. Okay, we're going to talk today about Mr. Brown Goes to Ottawa, my virtual trip to Parliament.
Yeah, how was it?
Like I said, just the strangest thing. We're also going to talk about the Globe and Mail. They have criticized a man for not being black enough. Okay, Globe and Mail.
Okay.
This episode of Shortcuts is brought to you by Adam Odell, Adrian Cabilio, Tracy Germa, Philip Cormier, Simone Blaine, Maxim Gertler Yaffe, Jonathan Warner, and Leah Watkus.
I support Canada Land because all organizations and news media outlets have implicit and institutional bias. I appreciate the work that Canada Land does to shine a light on those shadows and offer a different perspective. I also appreciate the investigative work that Canada Land has done, especially on Thunder Bay and Jaron's deep dive on We. I had heard murmurings about problems with their work for many years, but it was Canada Land who finally pulled back the curtain. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work.
Mr. Biddle.
Much, Mr. Chair. I guess my first question is to Mr. Brown. I found it unusual when I saw, I wasn't expected to be here until the last minute, but I found it unusual when I saw that a reporter was agreeing to testify at a committee. I've only seen it once in my 5 years, and it was Paul Wells who had firsthand experience leading a debate, and we were looking into a debates commission. What expertise are you providing? Journalists tell stories based on other people's information and sources that, and I respect that, that they can't be released, but what expertise are you actually bringing to the table beyond what you've reported based on other people's stories?
Mr. Biddle, I'm here at the invitation of the committee of which you are a part of today. I have agreed to come here and share the reporting that myself and my colleagues have done, which others did not, over the past 5 years.
Yeah, so Andre, I don't know what to tell you. I did a weird thing, and I went before, you know, the finance committee to talk about the We Charity, and not everybody thought I should do it. There were journalists who seemed very upset at the notion. Did you catch any of that?
I didn't catch the upset. I did hear that you had gone to testify with regards to the We Charity. Personally, I don't understand what people are upset about. I just don't care. They've always struck me as, I'm going to put this in a really sensitive way, I don't listen to lanky white men talk about Africa ever. I'm afraid. Personally, I just don't really have a heck of a lot of respect for what they do. Some of the stories that have come out about the way that they've done business, the way that it seems like they've taken advantage of young people that are looking for an entry into nonprofit work and into charity work. I've been singularly disgusted with the organization myself. So I don't really have any strong feelings about that.
Andre, I think ultimately that is like an overdue conversation about just like what is the nature of this kind of international development work. And some people are already starting that. But as we see, you know, it's not just sort of like a philosophical difference about like, oh, we don't like the way they're doing that. I don't think it's unrelated to the things that we're finding out about this organization. You know, like I think that the problems that are built into the foundation, but I'm not there yet because I'm still like reporting it out. So that analysis stuff, let me start with some petty grievances. David Akin, journalist David Akin, a lot of respect for David Akin, Glenn McGregor, Althea Raj, great political journalist, Chris Selly. They all seem to agree that I was trying to understand where they're coming from. This is a terrible precedent being set by me going before Parliament. And I was like, what do they mean? And it turns out what they mean is they don't want Parliament to haul journalists against their will in front of the government. And then we're sort of subordinate to the government. We might have to give up our sources. That wasn't the situation at all. I voluntarily went there because they wanted me to just tell them what I had reported. And part of what Canada Land supporters pay for is for me to spread our reporting as far as I can. And you know, it sounds good to me that legislators would know what we put on the record.
It seemed to me that if you were subpoenaed to go there, that'd be one thing. And that's what struck me was that you decided to go to give a testimony. That doesn't really seem to be a bad precedent to me if you're going to voluntarily, as a journalist, go and talk about your experience with regards to this organization. If you had received a summons and then decided to go, that'd be one thing, but that didn't seem to be the case. So I just personally didn't see what the problem was. And frankly, I find that people are being a little bit too precious about this whole We Charity in the first place. There's a lot of people that were upset that the Trudeau family was brought into it, that it seems like there was mudslinging. And I'm just like, they don't need our help. They don't need anyone's help. They've got enough help on their own. They've got enough people around them.
Well, Andre, you know, these journalists who protested me going there, they were not saying this out of any kind of fealty to we or to Trudeau. They were saying it because they care about journalism. And perhaps I wasn't summoned, but the slippery slope, Andre, if I go voluntarily today, perhaps you will be summoned tomorrow. It's a precedent that I'm setting and it's a bad one. That's what I ultimately was able to ascertain is the argument. And then I looked it up. Steve Paikin went before Parliament 10 years ago. Paul Wells went before Parliament 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't recall hearing a mumbling word from any of these people that they were hurting journalism when they did that. And I checked with Paikin and he didn't hear anything either.
I've never heard of any sort of bad precedent with regards to journalists going in front of Parliament ever. I didn't understand what the big deal was because I've never heard it be declared that going in front of Parliament to deliver a testimony of your own volition is a bad thing to do. Until this happened, I'd never heard that before. So I was a little bit taken aback. And frankly, like I said, I think people are being a little bit too precious about the charity organization, about the Trudeau family. It kind of seemed to me like this was sort of a side avenue to make that criticism without actually making that criticism.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think that they just, you know, I'm no Steve Paikin. I'm no Paul Wells. I think that they don't hold me in the same, I think it's personal, right? And that's, Andre, it's a reasonable position to not respect or like me. I just wish they'd say that, you know? Jesse Brown's testimony, I don't like him. Yeah. I don't like hearing his name.
I mean, shit, I don't like you.
Yeah, say that. if Jesse enjoyed a sandwich today, that gives me displeasure. I would like bad things to happen to him. Just be honest with that. It's okay. You'll find lots of support for that position. But don't act like you're trying to protect journalism with this bullshit.
Yeah.
I'm trying to report stories here. Like, you know, the interference from some of these organizations that, like, you know, some of them are doing some good stuff on it now. But, like, that's your contribution to this, to come try to... Anyhow, this is too granular. Andre, I just want to go through, like, this is just happening so quickly, and I hear you, a pox on all their houses, but I'm in the granular details of, as this thing unspools, how it's getting reported out, and there's kind of a high-stakes game being played with the Wii organization, I would say by the Wii organization itself. Can I go through some of this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. I mean, the big one today before committee was that it turns out that all along, this almost billion-dollar deal was not with Wii Charity. It was with this brand new entity. And they were explicit. They did this to limit their liability so that if the government gives them hundreds of millions of dollars and then, I don't know, let's say their charity goes bankrupt or something happens, they go insolvent and, you know, good luck getting the money back from this new organization. So,
yeah, as far as I understood, it seemed like almost the whole shell company game, you know, the holding company, the operating company. And as far as I was able to read, it seemed like they had created a charity arm, sort of an operating company, to limit their liability in the case that things go south. That's just how it came across to me. And that's a fairly common corporate practice. It didn't seem very insidious, but the fact that the government gave money to this charity organization that has no track record, essentially it's a brand new company. If you want to think of it as a limit to liability, then you also have to think of it as something that's brand new. Would the government offer that kind of money to a brand new organization in any other context? I absolutely don't think so. But I think of the government giving money to a brand new, say, like a Black-owned organization in that kind of a context, absolutely the fuck not. No way. Absolutely not.
No, and there are many volunteer and charity organizations that didn't even have the opportunity to benefit from this. You're right that that's a pretty common corporate thing to do. I don't know about charities, but, you know, I think you're right that we had every reason to do it. And the question goes to the government as to, like, seriously? Like, that's...
I don't put that on we because, like I said, I think it seems like a fairly smart move for a corporation to engage in. You're right. I don't know what the history
charity, of charity... philanthropic know. Organization. Listen, I wonder if we're going to hear from Justin Trudeau that he didn't know that, because listen to this. This is a clip of the Prime Minister way back when he was announcing this. Okay, listen to this.
When our public servants looked at the potential partners, only the Wii organization had the capacity to deliver the ambitious program that young people need for this summer that is so deeply impacted by COVID.
So he just seemed to catch himself. It seems to me like he knew he wasn't doing the deal with Wii Charity and broadened it out. So I'm curious what his defense will be. You know, moving on, it's great to see media looking into the property holdings of the Kilburgers. Mm-hmm. Vanmala Subramanian did a great, extensive job looking at the Wii organization's real estate, which is a separate affair from the Kilburger family's real estate holdings. So that's a great piece that I just think people should read in the Post if they're trying to stay on top of this. But I bring up this property stuff because, and I mentioned earlier, I think they're playing a really high stakes game over at Wii with whatever crisis communications experts they're working with. Brian Lilly, who I rarely have anything nice to say about from the Toronto Sun, has at least been trying to report out stories about this kind of weird labyrinth of property holdings. And he kind of, it seemed like he had a good one. I still think it's a good story, but this is really interesting what happened to Brian Lilly. And it's a cautionary tale here. So he had this kind of a scoop, I think, that there was this 21-year-old student at U of T who worked for Wii and bought a property for $1 million.
Yeah, I saw that.
Right. And then he goes on to say that she was the daughter of their CFO, Victor Lee. So this is all just like, what? What happens next is Wii comes out with a statement saying, we demand an apology from the Toronto Sun. That is not Victor Lee's daughter. This story is totally erroneous. And Lee is a very common Chinese surname. It's one of the most common. And this is the, you know, evidence that the Toronto Sun's report is completely, you know, fraudulent and fake. I kind of found out a bit about what happened here. It was kind of understandable why Brian Lilly would think that Mingzhe Li was Victor Lee's daughter. And it's not just because of the last name. She had the same address as Victor Lee, right?
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't he's just like, oh, all people named Lee are father and daughter.
I mean, I would assume not. I would assume that he'd have more to go on, especially if he's running. I mean, you know, say what you want about the Sun. You wouldn't assume that they're going to just put out blatantly false or non-research information. Yeah,
I would assume that at times, but not in this case. and it turns out that she is a relative of one of Victor Lee's close friends. It's still a very good story about this bizarre circumstance. But here's what happened behind the scenes. Brian Lilly was not as incompetent as you might think. He did get that information, and then he did go to We and say, is this Victor Lee's daughter? And they didn't answer him. They waited for him to publish and make the error. They allowed him to publish that. And then they immediately said, they put out their, you know, their demand, you know, we want an apology, a full retraction. And they also had affidavits proving their case that had been signed months ago. And I thought, wow, there, but for the grace of God, because it occurred to me that when we don't get clear answers from them, is it because they don't have answers or the answers wouldn't be good for them? Or
they're waiting for the punt. Yeah.
Because if Canada Land ever makes a mistake like that, it's like they set a trap. And then they use that one mistake to discredit everything you're saying and everything you're going to say. And that's actually like kind of a good strategy on their part, but I think it's completely in bad faith. And that's what happened to Brian Lilly. And now they're set, you know, basically his credibility on the story has taken a big blow. Meanwhile, he's got interesting revelations. He's doing some research on them.
Well, I would encourage people to read this story because, I mean, Brian Lilly has, he's written invective about some of the columns that I've written. One of them recently was a... He thinks that because I encouraged people who are part of the Extinction Rebellion to read the Communist Manifesto, he thinks that I'm a Stalinist or something of that nature. And he wrote a column, which, I mean, whatever. I don't really care. The Sun wasn't sending their best when they sent him out to write that piece. But at the very least, the story that he wrote was fairly detailed, and it included some interesting revelations that makes me think, I personally have never been comfortable, like if I go to the like the grocery store or the LCBO and they ask, hey, would you like to put a dollar towards the We Foundation or whatever, I would always say absolutely not. Are you kidding me? No. And this just cements my decision. They've been engaging in some sort of like PR chicanery, and the fact that they can't be straightforward about who they are, what they stand for, about their financials, they can't be straightforward about what it is that they've been putting their interns and young students through. If you can't be straightforward about that, then what do I not know about your operations overseas is my question. So yeah. I would never give them a dime out of my pocket. Absolutely never. And the idea that this organization has been getting these sole source contracts from the government, that's like, it doesn't reflect, I don't think, badly on We, because I never thought highly of them in the first place. It ought to reflect badly on our federal government.
You know what, Andre, like when we finally step back, when we once we know everything, I mean, they've been in our school system for years, thousands of school. I'm not going to go, okay.
Yeah.
It's just, it's happening. We're in the middle of it. And they're coming at, you know, there was a couple of days there where they were conciliatory. They apologized for their systemic racism. They're going to reform the organization, return to their roots. Now they're on the offensive again. They've attacked Kate Bain from Charity Intelligence. A lot of people read my interview with her. She's an independent charity auditor. They used to trumpet their good grades with her organization. Now they're attacking her. And they've said that she's obviously the go-to media source for negative, incorrect information. They're coming after her. And then even as they attack her for misinformation, they publish something that I think is at best incredibly misleading. They say, in the past 20 years, We Charity only filed for defamation with one publication, Canada Land, for publishing clearly erroneous materials. Andre, unless someone's about to burst into the office right now serving me with the notice that we've been sued, there's no lawsuit. I guess they filed libel notices. Maybe that's what they're referring to. But that puts a chill or a stink on our stuff. Oh, Canada Land is getting sued by them. Might happen tomorrow. Might happen in 10 minutes. Hasn't happened yet. So, you know, that's what's going on here. Like, it is a fight to get facts. And meanwhile, there's something else happening behind the scenes. I don't know if you saw this, like, bizarre. I mean, the Post is doing some digging on the Kilburgers. Meanwhile, this big feature ran on the Kilburgers over the last weekend that read, caring is cool. It was this fluffy profile of Mark and Craig. Did you see this thing?
No. Which one was this? I didn't see that.
This was something like, it was attributed to National
Caring
Post.
Is cool? What?
Caring is cool. And it was just like, there was no mention of the controversy of the scandal. It was just this like history of We that was just bizarrely.
Where did that run? I didn't see it.
That was on the weekend National Post, I believe.
Okay.
I think that came out on Friday.
Okay.
And I want to read to you from this, okay? Mm-hmm. This was attributed, nobody put their name on this, okay? This was attributed to National Post staff. Here's what I'll read to you. Both are charismatic, but in different ways. On camera, Craig always seems to be moving. He does a shoulder waggle as he talks, which sometimes ripples upward into a head bobble, suggestive of bouncy informality. Mark is more stolid. Always smiling, but mostly stationary. Wow.
One brother appears to have blood circulating through his body. The other is possibly a cadaver. We don't know. And we can't say, otherwise we'll get sued. What the shit is that?
I think I'm actually misreading it as like an actual, like there's a backstory to that. And if I wasn't immersed in this other thing, I would be trying to figure out, like, people think that the way that powerful people get stories planted in the press is that there's somebody in the newsroom saying, you know, never criticize this person, attack this person. It doesn't happen like that. It only happens when there's like, you know, a rare occasion when somebody's like, I want a story in support of somebody for some reason. And then journalists are asked to write a piece of fluff and they say, I'm not putting my name on that. I think I'm misreading that as a fluffy piece. It almost reads like a piece of Swiftian satire. Like somebody at the Post said like, oh, I've got to write something positive about the Killburgers. I'll write something positive. All right. Caring is cool. The story of the Killburgers. I mean, it's just.
All right. Caring is cool. At least one of them appears to have a heartbeat, but we can't say definitively.
I'm dying to know who wrote that, how it got in there, who made that happen, because obviously there's some kind of an effort happening behind the scenes to put that kind of story into the press. Nobody pitched that at a regular weekly or daily story meeting. Yeah. All right, that's it for now on this one. We'll keep people posted. We have stories breaking at a pretty steady clip. We duly note things here, even when we are completely immersed in other matters. We duly note things that need to be duly noted. I just want to, here, this is a nice contrast with the prose that I read earlier from the National Post. This is an obit for the lead singer of SNFU, legendary Canadian hardcore punk band, Chai Pig. And this is an obit that ran in the Globe and Mail. He died on July 16th at 57. This is by Jana Pruden. I'll read just a little bit of this. First, there was the music, heavy and wild. The band's name and acronym unspeakable to parents and still unprintable in this newspaper. And there was the scene. The kind of thing that thrilled youth and terrified adults in equal measure, with punks slamming into each other in mosh pits at the Spartans Men Club in Edmonton, or belly flopping off the balcony of Regina's Schnitzel House into the swirl of bodies below. On stage, he was wild and mischievous and glorious, spraying the audience with water, dumping bags of puffed wheat or popcorn, batting them with hot dogs. He performed as though he had been shot through with electricity, so lithe and free as he moved across the stage. At times, it seemed like he was flying. Andre, I was never an SNFU fan. I had my hardcore phase, mostly Bad Brains and the like, but that made me want to go. That made me feel like I missed out on something, never seeing SNFU. It's just...
Yeah, I got into the punk scene later, like when I was in high school. Actually, as a matter of fact, one of my high school classmates went on to become part of the band Fucked Up.
Okay.
Yeah, Mike Halichuk, he's in the band. He was a classmate of mine back when I went to Martin Grove Collegiate, but... I was late to the punk scene. Like, I think it was actually, it might have been Mike. Yeah, it was Mike that introduced me to Rage Against the Machine. And I liked Rage, but that wasn't really like the hardcore scene. It wasn't until I got to live in Palm Beach, Florida, which was also like a little mini punk scene. And my cousins introduced me to like a bunch of the local bands there and so on. So I felt like I caught on sort of late to the wave. And SNFU was one of those bands that unfortunately I didn't even catch on until my 20s. So kind of like you, I feel like I caught on to that whole wave fairly late. And yeah, it was really hard to hear that he had passed, that Ken Chin had passed.
Yeah, but it's nice to see him properly memorialized. It's nice to read nice writing. It's funny, Rage Against the Machine brought me to hip hop, it brought you to hardcore punk. So there you go.
Yeah, the crossover was intense. And you know, it's I was listening to like, oh God, I was listening to Smashing Pumpkins just on like the recommendation for a friend. And I was like, what the fuck is this nonsense?
I was like, that was a good question.
Yeah, I was like, I don't go for this soft shit. I was like, oh, man, this is what rock music is? I forget about all this. And then it was when I had gotten into like my freshman year of high school. That's when I got introduced into like the basics of the hardcore scene. And that was Rage Against the Machine. So it's interesting, the crossover, the way that happens. Duly noted.
Andre, do you have something for us?
A while back, some friends and I had a WhatsApp conversation just about how awful that mainstream black news has gotten, in the sense that it's become almost beholden to mainstream democratic interests. So we were going to put together a podcast by ourselves and just, you know, just have the five of us get together and chop it up and discuss different topics, and because they're all fairly smart people. And one of them came up with the idea, well, why don't we try to put together a podcast network? And I was like, that actually sounds like a really great idea. So we started off with a main podcast where we discussed things like bourgeois black narratives, what's happening in the news, to counter message some of the more insidious aspects. For example, like when Joe Biden went on the Breakfast Club and said that, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, like, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black.
Mm-hmm.
That got us so heated that, and there were people in black media, like black people in mainstream media, that were co-signing it. And we were like, absolutely not. We're going to counter message that. So we put together our main podcast, but then we got other people. We got a film and TV podcast. We got like an everyday political podcast. We have like an internationalist perspective based podcast. So we're putting together more podcasts right now as we speak. We're even looking at the possibility of a serialized podcast on black radical history. That is slave revolts, rebellions that have happened in Africa, all sorts of aspects of black radical history that you may not know about. And we called the entire network Resistance Noir. So that's what we're coming out with. And our launch is going to be next week.
Well, congratulations and good luck. It's a great thing to do. It's a fun, exciting thing to do. It's an overwhelming thing to do. You make commitments to get something out regularly. You stick to it. But it's wonderful to see it happening. And
I will say that I have a respect for what you do and what other podcasters do on a level that I didn't before. Having to produce not only your own podcast, but make sure that everybody else's podcasts get out on time, that's a labor. That's a labor of love.
Yeah. You feel me now. Yeah. You don't like me, but at least there's some new respect. I'll take it. Everybody go listen.
I may not like Jesse, but I respect him.
Go listen to Resistance Noir. I'll be listening.
All right, thanks.
Duly noted. Oh, I got one last one. I mean, we have to at least duly note the Governor General, Julie Payette.
Holy smokes. What the fuck? Apparently, we've got our own Amy Klobuchar. That's amazing.
CBC reports she's created a toxic climate of harassment and verbal abuse at Rideau Hall, sources allege. Her whole staff went to CBC anonymously. She's been verbally harassing employees to the point where they've been reduced to tears or left the office altogether. Four members of her communications team departed during the pandemic period alone. And it's all like she berates them, the accusations go. She berates them and cuts them down because the quality of their work is not up to snuff. Andre, what fucking work?
What could be so important in the governor general's office that you're like berating your employees to the point of tears? I can't believe that you had me misscheduled for this luncheon and then you fling a stapler at somebody's head. Get out of here. There's nothing that important happening in that office that you have to reduce your staff to tears that they go cry in their cars. Fucking brave.
I love it. I love it. I love this image of the Queen's representative in Canada being this kind of like regal tyrant. It makes me think like, was Adrian Clarkson setting up her staff in like a human chess game? Because it's like, is that what the governor general does?
Oh my gosh. I'm imagining like Michaela Jean setting up staff in like a battle to the death, like a terror dome. And she sets them up in a circle and just like snaps a pool cue in half and says, all right, the last one to survive gets to be my intern.
That's what the governor general does. It's just protocol. It's just Canadian tradition.
Duly noted.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional.
And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand.
The Globe and Mail has a racism problem, and it's not what you might be used to when I say a racism problem. See, their problem is they don't know that a person's race is not measured by their political views. Now, that's something that I know many of you know, but apparently the Globe and Mail needs to still learn that lesson, and I'm happy to teach it to them. Over the weekend, the Globe published an article by a divisive journalist by the name of Dakshana Bhaskaramurthy. And this article infers that a person's blackness is measured by his political views. The Globe's headlines for this article underscore the message that they want to send to me and to everyone else. Their headline assumed that because I am black, I am supposed to represent the will of all black people, which, by the way, if you didn't know, is impossible. They then changed their headline after receiving criticism for it to accuse me of anti-blackness. Yes, me, a black man, they wanted to call me anti-black. Now, how is that possible? What do they mean by that?
Okay, that's Jamil Giovanni on his radio show, or filling in for Evan Solomon. Andre, what'd you make of that?
I thought it was self-pitying and weak, frankly. I used to think fairly highly of the guy. Even when he wrote his book, Why Young Men, which I reviewed for Maclean's, I didn't like the book. I thought he was very wrong in many counts. I think that he didn't cite sources, that he put a lot of his own personal experiences and a lot of his personal prejudices and biases into that book. But I thought he came at it from a place of wanting to help people. And now I can see that's not the case. I can see that there's a lot of anger and self-hatred involved in his processing of what the pathologies are with Black communities that he believes it's his moral obligation to fix. He's not coming from an unknown tradition. It's actually a fairly common one. It's the same kind of tradition that somebody like Clarence Thomas comes from. It's like the Protestant work ethic, that there's something inherently vice-ridden and sinful about the existence of Black culture. And I think that his ideas of the subculture of violence, which in his book he calls the Hollywood gang subculture, whatever the fuck that means, the more he can do to call that out and publicize it, especially in white spaces, the more he's going to be able to embarrass Black people into finally getting their shit together. This is not an unknown strain of thought. It's the pull up your pants aesthetic. It's the Bill Cosby whistle stop tour. It's all of that stuff that we've been dealing with for the last 50 or 60 years. And I'm pretty sick of it, which is why I've been so critical of it.
Yeah. I mean, like, he's got a position. He's not the only one with that position. I thought of that Bill Cosby pick up your pants to the hip hop community. Like, you know, I might not agree with his position either, but let's be clear about something. Here's what he tweeted. Globe and Mail ran a headline about me today, essentially saying government hired a black man and that man is supposed to represent his entire race, but some black people don't like him.
Okay.
They've since changed it. And now the headline accuses me of anti-blackness. I couldn't make this up. Doesn't he have a point? Like, isn't he allowed to be wrong or to like have it?
Oh,
like,
of course he's allowed to be wrong. But if you're going to spread misconceptions about black communities, people are going to call your shit. If you say something that is just blatantly wrong about people, then you don't get to speak over and above them. They get to speak for themselves. So I think he has it like, well, I'm a leader. I get to say how it is that I feel, but you don't get to speak over and above people without them getting a say in how they feel about what you're saying.
But his point is that he doesn't speak for everybody. The Globe and Mail. So he's
but when you say things like, okay, I don't know if you saw, he posted a link to an article that ran in The Conversation a few months ago, but it was a chart and a graph that showed how, like, the length of the lifespan of people who are hip hop artists or involved in the hip hop art community versus other genres of music. You know, how long is their lifespan? And it was just the strangest setup graph. And it was showing that, like, people who were involved in hip hop, what the average lifespan was expected to be of people in the industry. You know, in folk music and like jazz and blues music, it was like 70, 75 years and so forth. And hip hop was like somewhere in the 40s, but it's also, hip hop is a genre that's only 40 odd years old to begin with. So what the fuck are you talking about? And the other one that really caught my eye was it showed the cause of early death for people in various genres of music. So in hard rock music or like hardcore music, there were higher incidents of death due to accidents and suicide. And accidents would also include, for example, drug overdoses. In jazz and blues music and in folk music, there was a higher incidence of heart disease, higher incidence of cancer. That's the reason that they had died. In hip hop music, there was higher incidence of people dying due to homicide. I think it was something like 51% of people who died early died of homicide. Now, a couple of things. One, if you were a black person, especially a black male, that's in hip hop music, you don't stop being a black male just because you've gotten into hip hop music. So all the concomitant social factors that are going to prefigure your early death are going to follow you into that music industry. So is it that you're dying because of the culture that you're involved in, or does it have something to do with you being a black male in America to begin with? Two, if we're to take that logic and that's true, wouldn't it also be true that if you are a folk singer, you're going to die of cancer? Hold on, hold the phones, hang on a second. So are you telling me that Woody fucking Guthrie is a genocide heir? He hasn't warned people that, hey, if you get involved into this music, you're going to die early of cancer? Why aren't we holding the folk singers accountable? It's just this misrepresentation of information that he does on purpose. And this is a Yale-educated human being. That he,
Andre,
can't seem to, he can't seem to read stats. He doesn't seem to have the necessary information to make these kinds of pronouncements, but he does anyway. And then he gets upset when people call him on it.
Andre,
yeah,
you're so right and well-reasoned that it's boring. It's a boring debate. I don't want to, like, we're not going to have that. This show's better than this debate of, it does hip-hop make people die? Okay. Like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Like, and it's a racist thing. I agree. It's like, nobody ever holds, like, you know, when Nick Cave sings Stagger Lee,
yeah,
it does a huge song about murdering people. No one says, listen to Nick Cave. No one says something racist.
No one about it.
Nobody Stagger says anything.
He's talking about shooting a guy that looked at his girl the wrong way. Like, what the fuck are we talking
right
about?
Right. So, yeah. I'm with you. I'm with yeah you. But that's not the point. The point is this. This is the original Globe and Mail headline.
Yeah.
Ontario hired a black community advocate, mm-hmm, but not all want him as their representative.
Okay.
That's a problematic headline, is it not?
Yeah, sure, I guess.
Like, he was supposed to be, first of all, he was not supposed to be, he was not there representing black people. He was an opportunity advocate for the province of Ontario.
Yep.
Which the Globe and Mail has misread. That's like, well, nice going, Doug Ford. You hired a black man who other black people don't agree with. And I'll tell you this, okay, there is not a major world event in the last 100 years, mm-hmm, that there have not been prominent Jewish voices on both sides of. I am really used to Jewish people being really wrong about things.
Mm-hmm.
Jamil is allowed to be wrong and still, like that's not... Maybe there's other reasons why he shouldn't have that role. You know what I'm saying?
I don't really care that he has the role or not. I don't. I really don't. I mean, whoever gets hired in government gets hired in government. Does he have a right to have that position? Yeah, sure. I don't have a problem with him having the role. What I have a problem with is him having the role and just saying ridiculous shit in public. That's what I have a problem with. If you have that kind of a platform in that position, you at least owe it to yourself to know about the problem that you're making pronouncements about. And if you don't know, then shut the fuck up. You're allowed to be wrong, but as a representative of the provincial government, then you owe it to yourself to be as right as possible, even when you are wrong. And if your arguments are paper thin and fucking flimsy, and you're making these pronouncements about the black community, you're saying that, oh, well, there's a spike in shootings in the black community because kids are getting together and talking shit on Instagram, and that's why they're mad at each other. Man, shut up. Here's my problem. Somebody that's as close, I'll say it's my brother, right? We are such close friends that we've taken each other as kin, right? So when I say my brother, I mean not necessarily by blood, but by kinship, right? He grew up in a completely different neighborhood than I did. You know, he had a completely different life than I had. The way that I grew up and the way that he grew up, even though we were both black and we've both faced many of the same vicissitudes, he's going to face them differently because he occupies a different class position, all right? This is somebody that, you know, was never given opportunities in school, ran with young people that later on went on to form gangs. Like, some of the people that he grew up with are now doing like life bids. He has experience with the foster care system and was bounced around from home to home. And you know what? He came out doing fine. I'm not going to say that everybody's going to come out doing fine, but the one thing that he didn't do was turn around and hate himself or hate his community because of the experiences that he was put through. He understood that because race being a social construct and the construction and the prefigurement of the black racial identity is one that's oftentimes filtered through poverty, through trauma, and that systems replicate that poverty and trauma. And him having gone through it himself, he understands the way that system works. Jamil is not somebody who grew up with that. And the neighborhood that he grew up in, I know, is not a bad neighborhood. Like, it's, I would say, like, it's a middle class neighborhood. And he has an issue with his father not having been around for much of his life. He has an issue with the way that what he calls Hollywood gang subculture sort of infecting the minds of young people and making them want to go out and like listen to hip hop music or carry guns or wear their pants low or whatever the hell he has a problem with. But if you compare his life to my brother's life and what he talks about black people going through, what my brother talks about black people going through are absolutely not the same thing. And they come to such wildly different conclusions. It tells me that what people are missing is that there is such a thing as class stratification inside of black communities. You can't have a black person who grew up in the middle class making these kinds of pronouncements about poorer black people trying to say, well, poverty is not a problem. The culture is a problem. Fuck you. You never experienced poverty. This is somebody who experienced poverty. Look at the different kind of conclusions that he came to. Is anyone going to my brother and asking him for his opinions, asking him for policy solutions? Absolutely not. He's not somebody that gets to be part of the conversation, but Jamil, because he is black, gets to speak for all of the community's problems, all of the community's vicissitudes, get to speak for all of the poorer black people and say, well, your experiences are not an excuse. You should be able to turn out like this because look at me. Man, get the fuck out of here.
It's almost as if you're suggesting that Jamil's ideology and message and the destructive impact on like tons of young black people is more important than my beef with the Globe and Mail's headline writer.
Yes, that's exactly. It was a very badly written headline. Like when I saw it, I did cringe. No, I
that's
saw it,
all I wanted.
I saw
Thank
it, I cringed,
you.
but I'm saying the article, the issue inside of the article that people were speaking to, and there were many people interviewed and they had a lot of smart things to say. Akwasio Wosubempo had many smart things to say. Ronaldo Walcott had many smart things to say. The problem that I had is that he took issue with the headline and he thought that he was being called not black enough. And no one has said anything about him not being black enough. The only thing that we've ever said is that his pronouncements about the community coming from his life experience, he doesn't get to make those pronouncements. That's all I'm saying.
Andre.
Yes.
Thank you.
No problem.
Okay, that's your shortcuts for today. I'm going to take a nap. It's never been easier to support us. Get ad-free versions of our podcasts. Just click on the link in your show notes or go to canadalandshow.com/join. It's $5 a month. It just goes right onto your podcatcher app. Do it. Email me at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read everything you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. We're on Instagram at Canada Land Show. Andre Demise, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Andre Demise, and you can find our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. The Patreon for it is patreon.com/RZNWA, and all the information about our podcasts will be there.
Our website is canadalandshow.com. Listen, I'm consumed by a story that I'm really passionate about, but there are other things and maybe bigger things going on, and this week's episode of Commons convinced me that every one of the deaths in long-term care during the COVID pandemic in Canada was preventable. Go listen to Commons. Go listen to Commons. This episode is produced by David Crosby. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Please support Canada Land.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.